When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.5. Last time we examined the experience of the British as events began to march towards conflict and confrontation with Colonel Nasser's Egypt. This march was aided by Anthony Eden's profound insecurities and his notable shortcomings as Britain's Prime Minister, but it was also aggravated by the failures of British foreign policy, which only angered Colonel Nasser and only heaped more shame on the British. Britain's conservative government, we have learned, epitomised the very definition of living in the past. Eden and many around him acted as though the glory days of empire were not gone, and that through its empire, Britain could match the powers of the Soviets and Americans. As spring 56 progressed, though, there was every indication that the first test of this idea would come from Egypt. So let's see how it went down, as I take you all to late February 1956. Selwyn Lloyd had something to prove. Having acquired a reputation as Anthony Eden's lackey, it was vital that he was seen to speak and act for himself. This, indeed, was why he found himself in Cairo on the evening of the 29th of February, 1956. He hoped, in this face-to-face meeting with Colonel Nasser, to communicate the concerns of the British and to intimate the best course Nasser should take. It was a mission which many before him had tried and failed, but Selwyn Lloyd was optimistic, while he sat with several British peers at the table, that Nasser could be made to see reason and sense. Lloyd later recalled the discussions in his memoirs, and he did not hide Nasser's difficulty in coming to terms with him, thanks to Britain's Middle Eastern meddling, which had resulted in Nasser's rivals, the Iraqis, being raised up on an advantageous platform called the Baghdad Pact. Selwyn Lloyd recalled, "Nasser said that there was no chance of improvement in Anglo-Egyptian relations unless we gave an understanding that there should be no new Arab members. Iraq could remain a member of the Baghdad Pact, although, as he said that, I had the impression that he meant to have Iraq out by fair means or foul. I said that the trouble was Egypt's propaganda against Britain everywhere in the Middle East, the Sudan, Libya and East Africa. Radio Cairo's broadcasts in Swahili were just incitements to murder. Nasser admitted that this propaganda was put over his directions. I then said that I was prepared to put to my colleagues the proposition that we would undertake not to try to persuade any other Arab country to join the pact, provided he would stop his propaganda. He said that he was prepared to agree to that, and that we should talk more about it when we met again the following morning." During the course of their dinner, though, Humphrey Trevelyan, Britain's ambassador to Egypt, was called away with an urgent message. The news regarded events taking place in Jordan, that curious successor state of Anglo-French colonialism. Old habits died hard, of course, and the British had since maintained an active interest in Jordanian affairs through the appointment of General Sir John Glubb, who commanded Jordan's Arab Legion contingent. Glubb had been in place for some time and operated, it was said, on King Hussein of Jordan's orders. But in reality, this knighted British subject had his homeland's interests close to heart above all, and Glubb had been an essential lever for controlling and remaining informed about Jordan's developments in the region. What Trevelyan had just been told, though, was that the nearly 60-year-old Glubb had been dismissed by King Hussein. On the surface, this dismissal of Glubb wouldn't have been that surprising. The man was nearly 60 after all, and King Hussein was only 20 years old, after inheriting the throne of Jordan from his grandfather. Hussein had to make an impression, and he couldn't do it very well with the aged British albatross hanging around his neck. What was more, Hussein and his Jordanian peers were becoming disconcerted with the increasing Israeli activities along the border. There was a train of thought that said no British commander would ever sanction the necessary attacks against the Israelis, and would be naturally inclined to favour the path of non-resistance to Tel Aviv. In short, Glubb's days had been numbered for some time, and neither Ambassador Trevelyan nor Selwyn Lloyd would have been too surprised to see him dismissed. What mattered, though, as ever, was perception. Selwyn Lloyd knew that his trip to Cairo had been roundly pilloried in the conservative press. If news emerged now that, while present in Cairo, a loyal British subject had been removed from his post, well, the people would start talking more. It was highly likely in Selwyn Lloyd's mind that Nasser had a large part to play in ensuring Glubb's removal. Could it really be a coincidence that Glubb would be released just as Lloyd and his peers were engaged with Nasser and due to meet him the following morning? In actual fact, as the record shows, King Hussein had acted in his own interests and was attempting to play many sides at once, but in the fraught atmosphere at the time, Nasser was seen everywhere. When the British met Nasser the next morning on the 1st of March, the talks went badly, as Nasser opened proceedings by congratulating the British on the removal of Glubb, which he saw as a bid to improve Jordanian-Egyptian relations. It was well known that Jordan and Egypt didn't see eye to eye, and with the removal of Glubb, Nasser claimed, Egypt and Jordan would be able to move closer together. Top form, Britain, top form. Of course, this act only rankled the British further because it made Nasser look supremely arrogant, but Selwyn Lloyd, to his credit, did his best to regain his composure. The two sides settled on a deal whereby no new members would be admitted to the Baghdad Pact, and in return, Nasser would halt his anti-British propaganda activities. On the way to the airport, Ambassador Trevelyan appealed to Lloyd to give Nasser the benefit of the doubt about the dismissal about Glubb and his role in it. In Trevelyan's mind, they could either cooperate with Nasser and believe in his best intentions, or the alternative was to adopt a thoroughly tough policy against him. We must then expect unrelieved hostility from him. We knew that he had the power to hurt our interests. If we decided on this course, we must hit hard and accept all the international consequences which would follow. I recommended that we should try the first course. I was supported by my colleague, who said that it was at least questionable whether we now had got the power to carry through a tough forward policy. As calm and reasonably collected as Lloyd and Trevelyan were, though, back home in London, Anthony Eden was itching for more information and for swift action. Anthony Eden knew, and did not have the composure to deal with, the fact that the dismissal of Commander Glubb would be presented as another British defeat in the Middle East, as another defeat of Eden's shaken government. Matters only got worse when, under Eden's orders, Selwyn Lloyd travelled to Jordan to talk with King Hussein about how affairs had progressed. According to the men who were there, there was some tension and anti-British feeling as they met with King Hussein. When the British press reported on the event, though, everything from Selwyn Lloyd being stoned by the Jordanian people to being held hostage in his car was being put forward as the truth. Look at how terribly the British are being treated here, the reports claimed. This would never have happened back in the day, when Britain truly commanded respect. Eden was also sensitive to these accusations and intimations, and blinded by the past as well, to consider that this was the way the world worked now. Instead, he demanded action, and considered cancelling the £12 million subsidy which the Jordanian government relied upon. If this was cancelled, some of Eden's peers warned, then Jordan would be forced into the arms of Nasser, even though Jordan wanted to keep its distance from Cairo, and King Hussein wanted to present himself as an independent leader in the Arab world, not dependent upon Nasser to get by. King Hussein, in other words, could still be immensely useful if Anthony Eden played his cards right. Yet, Eden hadn't been playing his cards right since the 1930s. In fairness to Eden, the version of events and the presentation of these events by the conservative press gave him no end of worry. One such example is worth citing. This is from The Times, where it was noted that the dismissal of General Globe from the command of the British Paid Arab Legion and the stoning of the Foreign Secretary in the British Protectorate of Bahrain attest to the bankruptcy of the policy of appeasement in the Middle East. These are the ineluctable consequences of the retreats from Palestine, Abadan, the Sudan, and the Suez Canal Zone. We are now very close to the final disaster. The challenge to our influence in Jordan and on the Persian Gulf, if left unchecked, must lead to the breakup of the Baghdad Pact. Our oil supplies, without which we cannot live, would then be in immediate danger. Our communications with other Commonwealth countries would then be threatened, and all Africa would be opened to the communist advance. In the glare of these dangers, only a complete abandonment of appeasement can save the situation. In recent months, the government has been charged with failing to give leadership. They now have the chance, as they have the duty, to confound their critics and promote a rescue operation to save Britain from disaster in the Middle East. By the account of one Minister for State in Britain's Foreign Office, Anthony Nutting, Eden was beginning to crack under the pressure. After sending a conciliatory telegram to Eden's office, which, among other ideas, Anthony Nutting had theorised that it might be worthwhile to submit the Egyptian problems with Israel to the United Nations, to grant concessions to Egypt, and to be seen to cooperate with the Arabs, Anthony Eden fired back the following explosive reply, this time over the phone. Anthony Nutting had sat down for a formal dinner when he was summoned to the telephone on the evening of the 8th of March. As he recalled, "It's me," said a voice which I recognised as the Prime Minister's. "What's all this poppycock you've sent me?" he shouted. "I don't agree with a single word of it." I replied that it was an attempt to look ahead and to rationalise our position in the Middle East, so as to avoid in the future the kind of blow to our prestige that we had suffered over Globe. "But what's this nonsense about isolating Nasser, or neutralising him, as you called it?" Eden asked. "I want him destroyed, can't you understand? I want him removed, and if you and the Foreign Office don't agree, then you'd better come out to the Cabinet and explain why." I tried to calm him down by saying that, before deciding to destroy Nasser, it might be wise to look for some alternative who would not be still more hostile to us. At the moment, there did not appear to be any alternative, hostile or friendly, and the only result of removing Nasser would be anarchy in Egypt. "But I don't want an alternative," Eden shouted at me. "And I don't give a damn if there's anarchy and chaos in Egypt." Did Anthony Eden really say all this to his underling, Anthony Nutting, one of the Ministers for State in Britain's Foreign Office? Anthony Nutting recorded this conversation in his memoirs, which were released in 1967, but it is very hard to imagine Eden being this aggressive, this single-minded, this delusional. We are taught as historians to be instinctively suspicious of sources which paint certain figures in an overwhelmingly positive or negative light. Anthony Nutting's recollection of events casts his role in government as one of a moderating influence, in contrast to the bullish Eden, and while it makes for striking reading, I would issue a caution here. On the one hand, Anthony Nutting hasn't had historians investigate his mental and physical health while examining his fitness for the premiership. Yet, on the other, when sources paint one individual in a given light, it is only right to ask questions. If we had a third hand, then I would say that Nutting is far from the only person within the British government to fault Eden in a big way, but he is one of the few to recount such a vivid and unflattering anecdote like this. Less than a week after Selwyn Lloyd had departed from Egypt, another figure arrived in Cairo to speak with Colonel Nasser. His name was Christian Pinault, and he was the Foreign Minister of France. In the first episode of our examination of Suez, we opened with the situation in French Algeria. The Algerian revolts, we learned, would last until the early 1960s, but we also saw the first hints of the distant Suez crisis as early as 1954, because a prominent boogeyman in the French mind when they considered their Algerian difficulties was the Egyptian leader. Nasser, the view went, was actively engaged in making as much trouble as possible for France in its Algerian backyard. It is entirely accurate to state, as one historian does, that France's road to the Suez Crisis began in Algeria, because it was in Algeria that the person of Colonel Nasser was elevated to that of a national enemy. Nasser funded and aided the Algerian rebels. He gave some of the Soviet-supplied arms to these same rebels, and he actively disseminated anti-French propaganda in Algeria. This was the commonly parroted view, and while it overestimated Nasser's abilities to some degree, there was truth in the idea that Nasser wanted to use Algeria to hurt the French, and that he wanted to be seen as the grand challenger to all vestiges of colonialism by everyone who had suffered from colonialism. Why then, after struggling through the Algerian War, did the French Foreign Minister decide that the time was right, in early March 1956, to meet with the Egyptian boogeyman face to face? In Christian Pinault's mind, the meeting made sense because both figures had something to offer one another. The French and Egyptians, after all, both disliked the Baghdad Pact because it increased British influence in the Middle East, and in return for a French pledge to criticise the Baghdad Pact, Colonel Nasser could pledge to refrain from aiding the Algerian rebels any more. This, incredibly, was what Pinault believed had been agreed after the meeting he had had with Nasser, but probably only because both men were forced to speak in perfect English to one another, and miscommunication inevitably followed. Pinault would then cry foul when Nasser inevitably did not stop supporting the Algerian rebels, but before long the French Foreign Minister determined to reverse his entire attitude towards Egypt. Where once he had expected to do business with the Egyptians and shut out the British, events over the summer of 1956 affected a change in French foreign policy, from one of rapprochement towards Egypt to total cooperation with Britain against Egypt. Detailing this adjustment in French foreign policy requires some explanation, since it was based upon that pivotal event in the lead-up to the Suez Crisis, Nasser's decision to nationalise the Suez Canal Company. This decision on Nasser's part, far from spelling disaster for Eden's premiership, surprisingly enough, granted him a new lease on life. Considering the tenuous experiences of the first half of 1956, Nasser's nationalisation of the Suez Canal Company actually threw Anthony Eden a political lifeline. Let's find out why.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The spectacle of Britain's declining influence in the Middle East made work very difficult indeed for Anthony Eden, but he reacted to these difficulties by becoming more radical, as Nutting's striking extract indicates. Anthony Eden began to argue for a policy of confrontation with Nasser in Egypt and across the Middle East, anchored by the decision to expand upon the Baghdad Pact, which Nasser despised. Anthony Eden believed it would be wise to ask the Americans to join the Baghdad Pact, and Selwyn Lloyd, his foreign secretary, supported this line as though it was his own idea. Selwyn Lloyd put forward the idea that we should make a further effort to persuade the United States to join the pact. We should seek to draw Iraq and Jordan more closely together. We should try to detach Saudi Arabia from Egypt by making it plain to King Saud the nature of Nasser's ambitions. We should secure further support for Libya in order to prevent the extension of Egyptian or communist influence there. We should seek to establish in Syria a government more friendly to the West. We should counter Egyptian subversion in the Sudan and in the Persian Gulf. Selwyn Lloyd's suggestions represented nothing less than an active and never-ending policy of confrontation with Nasser by hitting him in all the sensitive spots. This, if you'll recall, was what the ambassador to Egypt, Humphrey Trevelyan, had warned Lloyd about in February. If they were to oppose Nasser, they would have to go the whole hog, and if they did this, Nasser would certainly find ways of his own to attack and harm British interests, and so it would be better to come to terms with Nasser instead. But Lloyd was no longer listening to Trevelyan's tempered advice. He was instead towing his mentor's line, and had seemingly abandoned any semblance of moderation in the process. At this stage in the game, in early April 1956, Selwyn Lloyd was already suggesting a method of attack which would soon take on a life of its own. The idea that Britain would refuse to finance Nasser's pet project, the Aswan Dam. Under a coordinated Anglo-American finance deal in league with the World Bank, Nasser would be able to build his dam and would spend the next two decades or so paying the creditors back. While this was only fair, since when one borrowed money they should have to pay it back, Nasser was immensely sensitive to any suggestion that representatives of a foreign banking institution would arrive in Egypt to oversee these payments. While such a policy of protecting one's investment had been used by imperial powers many times in the past to justify more extensive interference in the rights of other nations, including in Egypt during the late 19th century, Nasser was resolute in his demands that no such policy, even the completely innocent and routine appearance by World Bank officials, would be acceptable. This rankled the World Bank officials to no end, but the Anglo-American commitment was also hitting its fair share of snags. Having promised Colonel Nasser a whopping amount of money, it was becoming apparent in both London and Washington that these promises could not be fulfilled, due to both financial and political reasons. In London, Yvonne Kirkpatrick in the Foreign Office gave his own views on the Aswan Dam. Where once it had seemed wise to give Nasser something to distract him from the conflict with Israel, now it was becoming apparent that Nasser would do what he wanted, including siphoning off money meant for the dam to spend on his growing military power. Other concerns which were swirling around put it that if the Anglo-Americans didn't finance the dam, then the Russians would step in and reap the benefits. Yet to Kirkpatrick, such benefits would be inconsiderable, since the Russians, in his mind at least, were already well entrenched in Egypt anyway. As Kirkpatrick concluded, "If the Russians build the dam, they will increase their influence in Egypt and will appear to be benefactors. But if, as I suspect, Nasser is already sold to the Russians, this advantage will be purely marginal. On the other hand, if we finance the dam, we will not only incur expenditure which we cannot afford, but we will have to foster the serious disability of seeming to do more for our enemies than we are prepared to do for our friends." In this case, when Kirkpatrick talked of Britain's friends, he was referring to those members of the Baghdad Pact who were all eager, in their own right, for British Western aid. As Kirkpatrick, Anthony Eden, and Selwyn Lloyd suspected, Nasser did want the Aswan Dam to be built, but if this construction came at the cost of his public image, as foreign financiers danced around the country, then he would also be prepared to wait. It so happened that at this point, the Americans were also feeling the pressure of prior commitments. In Washington, everyone from Republican watchers on big expenses, such as the subsidy for a foreign dam, for instance, to the cotton grower lobby in Congress, agitated for the cancellation of the promised financial aid to Nasser's regime. How could it not be guaranteed, it was asked in the National Security Council, that Nasser wasn't merely delaying the construction of the dam and using the monies he gained to beef up the Egyptian military and to attack Israel? This, of course, got the Israeli lobby on edge as well. As it happened, Nasser's diplomatic channels kept him well informed, so that by the end of June the Egyptian president, he had been proclaimed president during an election in mid-June 1956, where Nasser had been the only candidate, had all but given up on Western financial provisions regarding the Aswan Dam. Having just won an election himself, Nasser was also mindful of President Eisenhower's looming electoral campaign for November later in the year. With that hanging over his head, Eisenhower and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles were deeply sensitive to any suspect foreign policy behaviour, and included under this net was the outgoing payments to President Nasser, enemy of Israel, who promised to build his dam and absolutely spend not a penny on the military, which had once brought him to power. It was too politically risky for Eisenhower, while it was economically and politically risky for Anthony Eden. We know that President Nasser appreciated that the time had come to give up on the Western funding for the dam, because he was suggesting to his American ambassador in late June that Egypt should nationalize the Suez Canal Company to pay for the dam, a suggestion he was later to adopt with monumental consequences. In Congress, the foreign aid bill was put before the House of Representatives, where the finer points would be debated. Nasser expected this debating session to result in the exclusion of Egypt from American foreign aid considerations, but he made a show of hoping for a solution by instructing his ambassador to maintain an innocent face. So sure was President Nasser that aid would not be forthcoming from Washington that he cynically made a show of compromising. Nasser intimated that he would be willing to discuss a rapprochement with Tel Aviv, even while preparing for a war against Israel in the background, which, by the way, he was absolutely doing. The arms race between Egypt and Israel was something to behold, but Nasser was also seeking to cover himself diplomatically in the United States by presenting Egypt as taking the moral high ground. "Look at how willing to compromise Egypt had been in the name of foreign aid," Nasser could exclaim. And yet the greedy Americans had still refused to give the eager Egyptians much-needed aid. After the congressional discussions, a meeting was set up between Dulles and the Egyptian ambassador on the 19th of July 1956. It was during this meeting that Dulles informed his Egyptian guest, "Mr. Ambassador, we are going to issue a statement. I am sorry, but we are not going to help you with the Aswan Dam." While Dulles listed off his reasons, he also explained that he did not believe the Soviets would be able to afford the cost, as this would lead to troubles with their satellite states. The Egyptian ambassador departed the meeting in a completely different atmosphere to that which he had entered. No longer was intrigue or supposition sufficient to keep either side guessing. It was now clear that Americans would not be putting up the money, and that Nasser would have to find it somewhere else. Subsequent accounts of the Suez Crisis, in particular that by Selwyn Lloyd, attempted to paint the Americans as at fault for terminating their subsidy agreement. The cheek of this tactic is palpable when we consider the facts that Dulles had been careful to notify the British before he had acted, to find that London was eager to follow Washington's example and end their financial support as well for the dam. To avoid bombarding you with names, I won't add his to the mix, but shortly before Dulles had his meeting with the Egyptian ambassador, an undersecretary in the British Foreign Office recalled that there was a long departmental meeting in London on whether or not we should go ahead with the Aswan Dam before Dulles withdrew, and I was the only dissident in the meeting. I don't think I had more than one supporter. I said it would be a mistake to withdraw our funds, and I recommended that to Kirkpatrick after the meeting. The weight of opinion on the British side was in favour of withdrawing before Dulles actually told the Egyptians that he was. Why the rush to cancel the financial agreement before the Americans did? If you'll recall the two key facts about Eden's government, the intense dislike of President Nasser and the sensitivity to prestige lost, then this makes sense. Eden's cabinet wanted to cancel the agreement with Nasser first because they wanted to be seen to have led the way and to have stuck it to Nasser on their own initiative. By doing so, they would give off the impression of a confident, stern foreign policy concerned with British interests, rather than beholden to the actions of the United States. The very fact that the British debating became bogged down and delayed, largely by the desire to cautiously see what the United States did first, demonstrated the lie that this made of the British efforts to present itself as the strong first-rate power it desperately wished to be by 1956. Once the American deed was done, the British declaration followed limply afterwards, in spite of the keen objections of Ambassador Trevelyan in Cairo, who insisted that this would only force Nasser to take action. London temporalized. What action would a two-bit dictator like Nasser take anyway? What could he do to hurt British interests? Somehow the lessons and ideas of the last few months had been swept away. The warnings of certain British officials that Nasser was positioned to damage British interests and that Britain wasn't well positioned to answer back were drowned out by Eden's concern for his position and his efforts to claw back British prestige. The whole formula appears more like a situation familiar to scholars of Victorian Britain when Benjamin Disraeli led a personal quest against Russia and decried any power or person who dared to act without first consulting the British establishment. Those days were long gone, but this lesson was to be learned only very gradually and painfully during the next few months. It seems almost inevitable that President Nasser planned the whole thing, as soon as he learned of the Anglo-American hesitation in early summer. Expecting the deal over the dam to fall apart, Nasser planned for what he would do when it did, rather than hope for an improvement. The result was a carefully staged performance without equal in Nasser's regime up to that point. Over 100,000 Egyptians gathered in Cairo, centred around Liberation Square, 4 years to the day that King Farouk had been expelled from the country. It was then, in the dusk of a hot July day in 1956, that President Nasser made the announcement to a rapturous Egyptian reception. Egyptians were taking back what was theirs by right of geography and history, and few possessions fit this criteria more than the Suez Canal, more specifically, the Suez Canal Company. Next time, we will see how President Nasser presented this decision, and we'll examine what the immediate foreign reaction in both Britain and France was to this stunning decision. Until then, though, history friends, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2.5. Thanks for listening and for supporting us on Patreon, and I'll be seeing you all, you wonderful history friends, soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.